Now I'd like to talk with Dennis Hayes, who is the president of the Bullet Foundation in Seattle. First of all, Dennis, give us a little talk about what the Bullet Foundation does.
Well, the Bullet Foundation is a philanthropy based in Seattle, focused exclusively on the Pacific Northwest, trying to convert this corner of America and frankly the western part of Canada, British Columbia as well, into a sustainable society. So anything that will move any part of our industrial sector, or the economy in general, culture, cities, transportation systems, energy systems, towards sustainability, we're enthusiastic about and try to support.
Today's a very historic day. It is February 16th that we're talking, which is the launch of the Kyoto Protocols around the world. And that actually relates to the topic at hand, which is what Michael Schellenberger and Ted Nordhaus phrased as the death of environmentalism, particularly as it relates to that issue. What are your thoughts?
These are a couple of very smart people who titled their essay in an effort to be intentionally provocative and succeeded. They stirred up some serious questioning. It's, of course, a very long piece with a lot of assertions in it, but with reference to today, I think there's a core message that I agree with, which has been that not just the environmental community, but the scientific community and the world at large has been fixated on the debate over climate disruption, how big it will be, how inevitable it will be, how soon it will be, and has focused far too little attention upon the positive things that the world has, over the course of the last century and a half, really evolved into a place that is entirely fueled by the consumption of fossil fuels, which, in addition to its climate impact, has myriad other horrible economic, societal, cultural, pollutant public health impacts, and that this provides real opportunities to build a different kind of economy based upon the super-efficient use of renewable energy resources, and to do that in a fashion that promotes unexportable jobs. And if you're going to be erecting wind turbines in Wyoming or you're going to put solar panels on a roof, neither of those things can be done in East Asia.
So their effort to really expand the frame of this discussion from climate change and global warming out to sort of a more American framework of sustainability is perhaps what they're trying to create.
Yes, I think that at least in this part of their message, what they're saying is that you have to pay attention to what an audience will listen to. And if what you're talking, for the most part, if your focus is catastrophist, it's the melting of the Antarctic ice and the raising of the world's oceans, the flooding of Florida and Bangladesh and the loss of the entire sort of big chunks of the eastern seaboard. And then you throw in a few hurricanes and droughts and floods. It's a great movie, but it's the sort of stuff that people listen to and think, my God, that is like an act of God. There's not much that I can do about that. And they tend to turn off and move on to the latest Grammy show or American Idol or whatever it is that distracts them from it. Whereas if you go in with a very positive message, say, we've got a series of technologies that are actually very attractive, and that here in the United States, with the best educated population in the world, with a huge chunk of the disposable wealth of the world, with an entrepreneurial culture, with a skilled labor force, we should be able to lead the world into this rather glorious new direction. And that's not to say that a fair number of us haven't been saying that for the last 25 century, but it's not been the core message of the environmental movement, and there's an argument that it should be, or should have been.
Certainly that is what the Palo Alliance is all about.
On the one hand, you have to acknowledge that there is some reason out there to change, but you shouldn't be fixated upon the threat. You should be fixated upon the solution. And I think that just makes common sense in all sorts of political ways, and it also draws a relatively clean distinction between the policies that are being pursued by the current administration in Washington, D.C., and the policies that are being pursued in other countries around the world. You know, the American taxpayers paid for the development of photovoltaic arrays. We put them on space stations. We've had the National Renewable Energy Laboratory doing a huge amount of fundamental research on probably a dozen different compound semiconductors in different ways and different forms to use silicon. And And we've basically walked away from that huge amount of technological wealth. Last year, one company in Japan manufactured half of all the photovoltaic arrays in the world. The Japanese industry produced the vast majority of them, followed by Europe, followed in a very, very, very distant third by the United States. The one remaining significant, although small, photovoltaic company in the United States, Evergreen Solar, has just announced that it's going to be building in a joint venture a large new manufacturing facility, but it's placing it in Germany, where the government has created a market for this technology. I mean, this is just crazy, and we ought to be saying, we can do that, we can do it better, we can do it cheaper, we can do it faster here in the United States. But that's just not happening here.
So why aren't we? I mean, you're absolutely right. I agree with everything you said, and then we have to ask the question, why is this not happening here? It makes perfect sense. The message of the Apollo Alliance to really create essential energy independence or some variation thereof within 10 years is something that almost everybody who hears that message welcomes and understands and gets. But why is it that it is so difficult to really make it mainstream?
Well, let me address this with care, which I hope won't make it too boring, but because if I do it non-boring, it sounds conspiratorial, and there's nothing at all conspiratorial about it. It's very upfront and open. There are powerful economic interests, and they are consolidated in the oil and gas industries and the coal industry, which are basically American creations, and in the public utility industry, that do not want to see this happen. With the oil and other fossil fuel industries, it's because as you move away from them and into flows of energy from the sun, suddenly all of their multiple tens of billions of dollars of investments become worth very much less, assuming that we create a system in which these renewables do in fact either drive out or price the others out of the marketplace. Similarly with utilities, because the most attractive of these renewable technologies manufacture electricity, and you're going to be sending that through the grid. You're going to be either storing it in batteries or converting water into hydrogen and oxygen and then recombining it later in a fuel cell to let you have some energy later when the wind isn't blowing or the sun isn't shining. All of that is a vast, complicated new maneuver that the utility industry doesn't know how to do. It does know how to do what it's been doing successfully for the last century, and it's huge, bureaucratic, and enormously resistant to change, and has employees and voters in communities, every single community across the landscape. And when you add them together, the utility industry is by far the largest set of capital investments in the American economy. The oil industry has by far the largest revenues in the American economy. They are both very skillful and adept political players, and they haven't wanted this to happen. And to some very great extent, they have had control over the committees of Congress and the appointees to the Department of Energy to ensure that it doesn't happen. So it's happening elsewhere in the world, and eventually, instead of exporting these things, we're going to be importing them. So unless we change direction. I mean, that, and what I just did was exactly what the death of environmentalists say. You stop there, and you take this enormously bleak picture, and frankly, there's no reason that it needs to be a bleak picture. We still have scattered in universities across the country and in the superb scientific staff at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, the core of expertise that would allow us to leap rather rapidly again into global leadership if we had the national commitment and the money available for it.
Is part of the difficulty in this debate the term environmentalism?
Well, maybe. I tend to be somewhat less concerned by these what seem to me somewhat ephemeral public opinion surveys of how words are responded to by people. But it is clear that at least in the last little fleck in the last few years, while people continue to be, by and large, very enthusiastic about protecting the environment, they are substantially less enthusiastic, as measurable by a dozen or more points in public opinion surveys, about environmentalists and environmentalism. So if we can protect the environment without environmentalists doing it, maybe that is a desirable thing. I think that this is just one of those little quivers that happens in charts when a few prominent people say some things that alienate other people, and in the great sweep of history, I expect just as there will continue to be civil rights advocates and there will continue to be feminist advocates and peace advocates and what have you, social justice, human rights, environmental advocates will continue to play a very important role in America's future as well.
Therefore, you believe that environmentalism is not dead, that it does have a future?
Yeah, I think that there's a paper ready to be written that's, I hope I don't offend any of the religious sensibilities in your audience, but the resurrection of environmentalism. I mean, it headed down a pathway that caused its focus to be too much on the negative side and insufficiently upon the positive alternatives, and I think it's healthy that we've had this debate, and I think we're going to be seeing signs of people much more focusing upon not just the threats that we face, not just what we're trying to stop, but the affirmative visions of a society that all of us would really like to raise our children in.
So I'm just curious if there are words that possibly you think may work better or feel better or that we might look at into the future. Because it kind of is a debate about words, really.
No, I think we really need to work at the substance beneath the words and what it stands for, and the words will ultimately come to mean what their principal proponents want them to mean. I mean, if you look at, say, the word that is most ascendant today, probably, in American politics, conservatism, I think we were probably both old enough in 1964 when Barry Goldwater went down in flames, got maybe one-third of the votes in a presidential election, and in intellectual circles, conservatives were almost uniformly thought of as Neanderthals dragging their knuckles across the ground and talking about bombing Vietnam back to the Stone Age and expressing views that were frankly blatantly racist. And people who had clever new ways to use the market to achieve some good things began to redefine what conservatism meant and began to think in terms that actually created some relatively creative ideas about ways to approach problems. That all sort of culminated in Newt Gingrich and the contract with America in 1994, sort of 30 years later, in a situation that now has conservative forces in charge of the House of Representatives, the Senate, the White House, the full administration, and the federal judiciary. You know, the words words are not our problem. And I think the environment, candidly, is a very good word for what it is that we're trying to talk about, which is to recognize that the Earth as a whole is interrelated, functions as a broad biological system, that we are part of that system, and that the principles that govern, the broad ecological principles that govern how you have a sustainable population of elk, or a sustainable population of wolves, or a sustainable population of orcas, those broad principles apply to all of the animals on Earth, including human beings. We have some very, very important elements that are not with creatures that don't have opposable thumbs and sort of large frontal lobes, but still bringing principles of ecological design to our cities and to our industries, I think, is a crucial element of having a sustainable, healthy, attractive future for our children and grandchildren. I don't want to run away from that vocabulary.
Dennis Hayes, president of the Bullitt Foundation, I want to thank you so much for giving your thoughts on the future of environmentalism, and let's continue our conversation again.
Good, Sydney. Thanks for calling.